Good afternoon. I'll call the meeting of the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Yeoglin moves the minutes of April 6. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Thank you, Representative Yeoglin. Minutes are approved. Welcome, members and members of the audience. Today we have a presentation by department, and what we're going to do is we're going to allow them to go through their entire presentation, and then if you would jot down your questions, and I think that'll be the most expedient way, an efficient way to get through that, and because we want to certainly hear that, and then we'll take questions after that. So welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony. Go ahead.
My name is Nancy Dobenberger. I'm with MnDOT. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Engineering Services Division. I want to thank the committee for having us here today to talk about alternative construction delivery methods and to give some updates on some major projects. Also, I want to thank the state legislature for their support of alternative delivery methods in the past and hopefully moving forward as well. We've achieved much success through some alternative delivery methods with our projects, and we'd like to move that forward. A question came to us as we were preparing for this presentation today. The question was, is it always a goal to build in cost efficiency as part of our construction projects, or are higher costs justified? And my response to that would be, it's always a goal to build in cost efficiency, and it's always a goal to minimize impacts to the traveling public with our construction projects, too. However, we also have other goals, of course, worker safety, the safety of all who are involved in the project, as well as the quality of construction. So those are goals that we're trying to achieve with all of our projects. So today, we're going to I'll give you a little overview of what we'll be talking about, give you an introduction to the design build and our CMGC, Construction Manager General Contractor Delivery Methods, how we select these projects, other procurement, other procurement methods, and then we were also asked about selection results on some of our major projects, and then we will give an update on four of our major projects that were asked about. So with that, I'm going to start talking a little bit about design-build. And our first design-build project was in 1997, but our first modern design-build project was in 2002. That was our Rock 52 project in Rochester. Typically, we have about 15 to 25% of our construction program that we deliver by design-build, but that's by cost. We are limited in the number of projects to deliver by the design-build delivery method by statute. That's 10%. So it typically ends up being about 2 to 3% of our program by number. So when you compare those percentages, it's usually the larger projects, that larger cost projects that we tend to deliver with design-build. It's been about 3 to 5 projects per year over the last 5 years. And so I'll talk a little bit about strengths and weaknesses. And maybe before I do, just say one of the first qualities about the design-build delivery method that appealed to us was our ability to accelerate projects, the delivery of projects. And in fact, just go back those slides of mentioning Rock 52 and the I-35W bridge. With the Rock 52 project, we figured that we saved about a year and a half in delivery time by delivering a design-build. And the 35W bridge, of course, that was the emergency bridge replacement. We delivered that in less than a year, so we had success with the accelerated schedule on that project as well. But in talking about strengths and weaknesses of our design-build delivery method, some of the benefits are that besides accelerating the delivery, that it allows us to be able to transfer risk or assign that to the entity who's best to manage that. And it also allows for some competing or innovative designs. The top photo shows our Hastings Bridge project. That was one in which we allowed the contractor to propose what type of bridge they would like to build out there by allowing two different alternatives in the contract. And then they could also think about how they'd like to stage that construction of the type of bridge they propose. And they propose based on their own means and methods, and they can be innovative in how they deliver that project. And the lower photo shows our Maryland Avenue I-35E bridge. So this was an interchange reconstruction project, standalone reconstruction project, just that interchange, where we went design-build for the delivery method, and we put some time frames in the contract to encourage innovation. In this case, the bridge was built off to the side, and the contractor used these trailers, self-propelled modular transporters, to wheel the bridge into place after the old bridge was demolished by shutting down I-35E for just a very short duration of time. So that's an example of some innovation that can be proposed into the contractor's proposal as far as design-build projects are concerned. Also along 35E, as part of the big MinPass project, we had some time constraints on shutting down lanes at the Larpinder Avenue interchange, and with that, the successful contractor, Ames in that case, proposed to use slide-in bridge construction. So they built the new Larpinder Avenue bridge just to the north alongside the old bridge. When the old bridge was demolished, they slid it into place. So when I talk about risk transfer, I'll give an example. I'll use the slide-in bridge construction as an example. So out there, when overnight they had I-35E shut down and they were sliding in that new bridge, the sliding mechanism didn't perform exactly how they had planned it to perform, or initially anticipated anyway. So the contractor on their own made adjustments right there in the field and was able to move the bridge into place. Unlike a bid build project where MnDOT develops the plans, the construction documents, the contractor might have paused and said, MnDOT, this isn't working, what are you going to do? And it would have been up to MnDOT to potentially change the plans and that sort of thing. So the contractor was able to make the change, adjustments right on the fly, and that's an example of where we like to see risk allocated to the right entity at the right time. And that's, when I say risk transfer, that's an example of what I'm talking about. But so drawbacks, though, for design build, we don't see that cost efficiency as much with non-complex projects. So as I mentioned earlier, we tend to use it for more expensive or higher cost projects. It allows us less control over the design. So MnDOT needs to react quickly once designs are turned in for our review, since the designer is working for the contractor, and we're allowed certain windows of design review time, and that is pretty resource intensive when those plans come in. So it's kind of an all hands on deck. We pull people off of other projects to quickly review plans as they come in. Also, third-party permits or agreements that are required, that can be kind of tricky, because typically in our design build process, we will obtain those permits during that design process as an agency, MnDOT obtains those. And oftentimes you need to have enough design completed in order to be able to obtain those permits. Well, in design build, we don't get to that level of design until the contractor is already on board. So then there's more interaction there between the contractor, the permitting agencies, and MnDOT. So it's a little more complicated that way. That can tend to be a drawback, but we've worked through that as well. Two different types of scoring we've used for design build. One is what we call low bid. So even though it's design build, it's low bid. And what we require there is qualifications, but it's basically just pass or fail. And so all those who pass the qualifications that we are looking for can then bid on the project, and then it goes to the low bidder. More traditionally, or more recently, though, we've used best value, and that is where we ask the contractor team, to submit a formal technical proposal that'll be scored, and that works best for major bridge project, complex highways, rather unique designs, or where we have a lot of or major risk to be transferred. But then we weight the price and the technical score, and the technical component is determined before we go to RFP. Historically, well, when we started out using best value design build, we went about 50-50 on the weighting between the price component and the technical component. What we've done recently is just sat down before we go out for RFP and request for proposals, and decided what elements of the project are important for us to have some scoring around, and then what is the value to us, so assign points accordingly, and then it's up to about 50% of that overall equation then. Criteria can include for the technical component things from approach to design, how they're going to manage environmental impacts, what their substantial completion date is, and how they're going to achieve that by their schedule, and who are the qualifications of those who are going to be proposed as leading the project. So that brings me to CMGC, our Construction Manager General Contractor, and that is a newer method of delivering projects. It's an innovative delivery method that it takes into account some of the benefits of both design bid build as well as design build, and it's rather new to our industry, but we were pursuing it because we wanted to add another tool to our toolbox in how to deliver projects effectively. And so with that, we had the state legislature actually in 2012 gave us authority to deliver 10 projects with this method. It was also that year that as part of MAP 21, the federal bill was enacted. It moved CMGC from being experimental to having states actually use it to deliver projects if their state allows for it. And again, we appreciate that the legislature gave us that authority. We've done two projects that way. Now we're in the middle of delivering two projects with CMGC. I'll talk about that in a moment. But what is CMGC? It allows us to contract with a construction contractor early on so that the construction contractor can provide input into the design. And it allows us to choose that contractor to construct the project also if we can come to an agreement on the price in the end after we've developed the plans, and allows for collaboration between the designer, contractor, and MnDOT as we're developing the project, and then helps us to make informed decisions in how we're going to meet those project goals and reduce the risk along the way. And when it comes to reducing risk, the risks of the unknown in the beginning of project delivery, then we can reduce the cost and the potential for project delays. So that's why it's important to us to reduce those risks along the way. So this graphic just shows a little bit of the difference between our design bid build model, and our CMGC model. So on the far left, that model shows the green oval is the owner at the top, and we have a separate contract with the designer as well as the contractor, and they're more sequential. So we contract with the designer to develop the design and the construction documents, and then we, once those are prepared, go to bid and then have a contract with the construction contractor. Well, under design build, we just have one contract with a construction contractor who subs to a designer. So the designer is working for the construction contractor, and MnDOT has the contract with the construction contractor. Then under CMGC, we have the two separate contracts, much like design bid build, but they're both procured at the same time, and then there's collaboration that takes place between the two. So I'll talk about the different stages of CMGC. The procurement process is beginning. That's when we're getting a CMGC contractor under contract, selecting them. We can choose that contractor either just qualifications-based or best value. As I mentioned, we've done two projects so far. We've chosen one just qualifications-based, and then we've done a little bit of a best value on the second one. And we'll enter into a professional technical services contract, much like we would with a design consultant, so PT contract, as we call that, for this pre-construction phase. And then in pre-construction, the CMGC contractor provides input into the design and the schedule. We talk about risk, constructability, the cost, and in fact, we request their opinion of probable construction costs at different milestones along the development process, typically the 30%, 60%, and 90% plans completion. We'll have formal workshops at those points to review the design, the cost, the risk, and call those interim pricing milestones. So wanted to mention, too, then if we come to agreement at the end, if we come to agreement on the price, and by that, I mean, we've decided that based on some other estimates we get, typically we'll have an engineer's estimate, so our consultant, our design consultant's developing an estimate, as well as another estimate, an independent cost estimate. We use those to compare the contractor's estimate to ensure that the contractor's estimate is in line with what we think the project should cost. If it is, if we come to an agreement on that, then we can award that contractor the project. That's the bid validation process. But if we decide that we can't come to an agreement on the cost, then we terminate the contract, and we could put it out for bid, design bid build at that point. So that's an option we have. And the advantage to continuing, though, with that contractor for MnDOT is then the constructability review, the information that went into why the project was designed the way it was, is what we're going to be realizing then in the field, whereas another contractor to come in at that point could do things quite a bit differently in the way they approach the project. So there is an advantage, of course, MnDOT, to stick with that contractor, but we're willing to cut it off at that point and go low bid if we can't come to an agreement on cost. So I'll just kind of quickly go through some strengths and weaknesses. I've kind of touched on these a little bit already, but one of the strengths is that MnDOT can retain the control of the design. So unlike design bid build, it's not so time sensitive as far as reviewing the design, because we're at the table for the design the whole time. It allows for innovation, risk mitigation, improved constructability, much like design build has those elements to it. Provides us a little more cost certainty, so we have some indication along the way what the costs are going to be at those 30-60% milestones, and then again at the toward the end before we get a final cost proposal. Drawback is now suddenly we're doing a little negotiating on price, so the contractor gives us these cost proposals and we can dig into those a little bit and take a look at why their production rates are different than what our independent cost estimator thought they might be. And it can involve some negotiation, which is actually a good thing, but it's just different than what we're used to with low bid, where we take the low bid. And again, it just requires more resources, staff resources, in the pre-construction phase. So when do we want to consider CMGC? Projects that can benefit from contractor involvement during the pre-construction phase of the project are real good candidates for CMGC. So when there's inherent third-party risks, such as risks that are hard for MnDOT to define, like if there's going to be a long lead time on fabrication of certain elements, or utilities that need to be moved and it's not quite defined yet, the contractor can help with understanding how that'll all fit into the project schedule and how they would approach that. Those are good projects for using this method. And then when there are technical complexities that new technology could be used, another good reason to use CMGC. Complex construction staging, so what's going to be constructed first, second, third, contractors right there at the table helping the designer work through that. And when there are schedule or budget constraints, as I had mentioned previously, those are important to making the decision on what delivery method to use, and CMGC is good when you have those challenges. So why did we use CMGC for the Winona Bridge and for the Highway 53 bridge? My colleague, Mr. Western, Kevin Western here, who is with me today, he's our state bridge engineer, is going to talk about these in more detail when he gives some project updates. But just in general, for the Winona Bridge, it's a historic truss bridge built in the early 40s, and it's had some repair needs over the years, and most recently, and in fact, not that long ago, where it needed to be closed down for some repairs, and it's a 70-mile detour. So this was a project that we wanted to get at as quickly as possible in order to not delay repairs to the old bridge. But also other needs out there is the corridor has a future four-lane need, and so with that we're building a new bridge alongside of it. Traffic will be moved on to the new bridge once it's completed later this year, and then we'll be rehabbing the old truss bridge. So CMGC allows this work to be accelerated, and there's value in having the one contractor building the various stages of this project. And also, with the challenges that we have for rehabilitating this old bus bridge, it provides us the ability to get that contractor review constructability information into the design, which has been very beneficial. And Kevin will hit on that in a little bit here. But also with the uncertainty of costs, especially with the rehab of the old bridge, and we've been realizing some of the cost challenges that we have on that part of the project. And that was another reason we thought CMGC would be very good for this project, just to understand those costs along the way before we go to bid letting. So then with the Highway 53, that's a project here in Virginia, Minnesota, where we need to relocate the Highway 53 corridor out of the area that it's on right now, which is planned for some future mining. Need to be out of there by November of 2017. And to meet this very aggressive schedule and best manage a lot of these project risks, so building a new bridge over this old mine pit, we thought CMGC would be very good for that. One, to get that constructability information into the design, as well as help us with this a very aggressive schedule. One thing that kind of came up on this, too, that just another reason CMGC is good for a project like this, is as we were putting plans together, we thought the bridge contractor would need to come in and barge in equipment into the site, but as it turns out, they proposed to build a temporary causeway to move their equipment in that way. So that wasn't something we would have necessarily assumed that the contractor would do, but having the contractor at the table, we were able to work that out. It's going to be more cost-effective that way. Kevin will touch on that a little bit more in just a bit. But CMGC, again, allows MnDOT to work collaboratively with the contractor as well as the designer to develop cost-effective designs that best meet our project goals. So how do we select which delivery method we're going to use? We consider factors such as cost, schedule, project complexity, and innovation that could be used, the current status of the design, so how far into preliminary design we've been able to get to a certain point, what sort of staffing or workforce we have available right now, and again, where risk is best allocated. So those are some factors, and what we do is we review the program regularly, look for good candidate projects, and then for those projects cited as good candidates, we'll hold a delivery workshop and evaluate these different factors, have some panel discussions, come to a recommendation, and it'll get recommended to MnDOT management and other stakeholders and partners before just final decisions made. And so I've been focusing on CMGC as well as design build, but I wanted to mention another delivery method that we've been using a little more recently and we'd like to continue to use. We call it IDIQ, it's indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity. And that's the type of contract where we provide for an indefinite quantity of work, but over a specified time, typically 2 years. And we establish a minimum quantity of work as a part of that contract. So contractors bid with this minimum quantity in mind, but knowing that more work could be added to the contract. And the way that's beneficial to MnDOT is if we have more needs out there of this sort of work type, and we want to be able to add to it if there's a little more money in our state road construction program at the end of the fiscal year, it helps us streamline the delivery of that work. And if there's a price fluctuation during that time, such as fuel prices, if they escalate or drop, we could basically just end the contract on the minimum quantity that we had established. And you know, certainly we can do that. But we've had a lot of success with being able to add some work to the contract as well. So we hope to do a little more of that. A plus B contracting, that is something we've been doing and had some good success with our design bid build or low bid type of delivery method. So A plus B is the construction cost plus the time. So it's a value of calendar days that's assigned a certain time, and that gets added to the cost. And I'll touch on that in a moment because that was used for our St. Croix Bridge project. The question also came to me, how do we hold contractors to the commitments in the contract? And we have a few mechanisms for doing that that we put in the contract. One is what we call liquidated damages. So with liquidated damages, we set a completion date. It could be a final completion or substantial completion, I guess, as well as interim completion dates. And if they're not met, we can impose a fine per day for the contractor who fails to meet it. Now, fines can be imparted, but then also it could be negotiated, too. If the contractor feels that the delay was out of their control, that's something that they can come back to MnDOT and negotiate. So it's not always on the contractor. So liquidated damages are in there. We can enforce them. In some cases, we might not charge those if it's one of those things where it was additional work that MnDOT added to the contract, and that's why it took longer, that sort of thing, as an example of why we couldn't pursue those. Lane rental, similar to that, put in the contract that lanes can be shut down for a certain number of times, certain number of lanes. If the contractor needs more time than that, then they can pursue lane rental from MnDOT, and basically we can then deduct that from their contract payment. It's basically a fee. Locked incentives are something else we put in the contract. It's basically a no excuses bonus, and that is something that the contractor can receive if they make completion dates that are established in the contract. And most of the projects where we've had those, the contractor has been successful. He said it's a no excuses bonus, but now if there, as I mentioned before, something where it's out of their control that they didn't make it, they might not get the locked incentive, but that's not necessarily then a case where we would go ahead and charge them the liquidated damages. You know, if there's something that's added or something that was out of their control, maybe they wouldn't get the locked incentive. But it's not necessarily the case where we go in and charge them liquidated damages. So also, if there is work that as part of the contract was not performed, that or something was done that was not agreed to in the contract by MnDOT, we can take deducts or negotiate with the contractor for some sort of betterment in the project. So that question's come to me recently, too. What about a project where the contractor didn't do something they were supposed to, or tore out some pavement that they weren't supposed to tear out, or what have you? Well, we can sit down with the contractor, either take deducts or negotiate a betterment of the project in another area. So those are just some options that we have that we pursue. So I was also asked, though, to talk about scoring criteria in some of these alternative delivery projects, these larger projects. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here since you have it in your packet, but thought I'd first talk about the Winona Bridge. So that was a qualifications-based selection in selecting the CMGC contractor. It was our first CMGC project, and so we used this qualifications-only way to select. And this slide shows some of the scoring criteria. 100 points possible for shortlisting first. We first shortlisted contractors. In this case, we had four proposers, and they all were shortlisted. They all met the qualifications. Moved on to request for proposals, and had another 100 points possible. There we had project approach, project innovations, CMGC design process experience, and their approach to cost estimating. And how did it come out? Well, of the four contractors, Ames came out on top. So they are a CMGC contractor for the Winona Bridge. And then for the Highway 53 alignment, our Department of Administration had strongly recommended we do more of a best value selection. They thought it was important to have the price of the professional technical contract be part of the selection. We had some concerns about that because actually our contracting community had raised a red flag on that and said, well, wait a minute. Now, we could bid something pretty low for that professional technical contract cost and then just hope to make it up later if we're the successful CMGC contractor on the construction contract, which was a very good point and something we needed to be concerned about. So in the end, we had the pre-construction price proposal for that PT contract, a very small percentage, 3 of the 100 points. But in this case, 100 points possible, qualifications. We went right to RFP. This was a pretty fast-track project, but key personnel, technical capabilities and experience, their process management for CMGC, how they're approaching the project, innovations, and their approach to cost estimating were all criteria that were considered. And in the end, Kiewit was the one who came out on top for that. So Kiewit is our CMGC contractor for the Highway 53 realignment project. And you have these numbers in your packet. I'll just point out on this slide. So then when it came to, or down the road now, working on the project and what the project price estimates came in at, the far left column here talks about the different work packages. Work packages 1 through 4 as part of the Winona Bridge project. These are all part of what it took to build the new bridge. And the left column there of numbers shows the CMGC contractor's bid on each of the 4 work packages. Next to it is what we call the owner's estimate. So that was MnDOT cost estimators working with a consultant. We had us help cost estimate. That was actually kind of an extra estimate we did since it was our first CMGC project. But then we had the more traditional engineer's estimate. So the designer and their estimating expert came in and provided us an estimate. And then our independent cost estimator with the contractor construction experience had their estimate. So as it turned out, it was all in line here for Winona with the first 4 work packages. And you'll see the engineer's estimate and the independent cost estimate tend to be a little higher, although that's not unusual for design bid build and design build as well. So this was all pretty much in line. And now we're on to work package 5, the rehab of the old bridge, and Kevin's going to talk about some challenges there. But before we do, I'm going to talk about the Highway 53 realignment cost estimates. A little different here. Now you'll see there are just 2 work packages. The first one was just procuring the materials. So this is the bridge girders. We call it an early steel package. The CMGC contractor's bid was pretty much in line with the other 2 estimates. Work package 2, the CMGC contractor's bid was a little higher than the engineer's estimate and independent cost estimate. But we came to where we understood the differences. The percentage-wise, it was in line with the way we award projects with other methods, and we moved forward with it, and things have been going along very well. So I wanted to also touch on the St. Croix River Bridge. So now these numbers reflect the costs associated with the project that's going on right now, the river bridge construction. So the early foundation work that took place in the river before the Lunda Ames joint venture took over the project is not reflected in here. So this is just the river bridge cost. But the far left shows what we call MnDOT's engineer's estimate. And then we have the 3 different contractors who bid on it. Now, this is A plus B. So the top row of numbers shows the pure construction cost. That second row reflects the construction cost plus an additional cost of time, and that's valued at $50,000 per day. So you can see the difference there is third row, and that equates to the number of calendar days shown there at the bottom. So the Lunda Ames joint venture was the successful low bidder on the project, and they're working on that project right now. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Kevin Western, our state bridge engineer, who is going to give some updates on these projects.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Kevin Western, state bridge engineer. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to be here and talk about 3 of the projects. The first one I'm going to talk about is the 53 relocation project. This project came due to some issues with the alignment of 53 now on the roadway in the property that we're sitting on. In 1960, when the project was built, we built a piece of roadway on a easement. And we had an agreement at that time that with a 3-year notice, we would vacate that area. And in 2010, we were given that notice. As we went through and we looked at developing the project in 2012, we were able to get an extension out to May of 2017 to let us keep working through the issues and develop a scope of project, the location of the project that was best for all the stakeholders. As we sat down in early 2014 and 2015, we developed what the project goals were. Number one was to relocate off that easement. But the main other main important piece was to make sure that when we relocated, we were on MnDOT right-of-way, that we actually had bought that land and we would not have a future problem going forward. We also, because we were working through the process, we needed to expedite the environmental approvals, and we also needed to move forward with the design concurrently to make sure that we met those goals. Also, we wanted to make sure that in looking at all the different alternatives that we were trying to control cost as best we could. So, as Nancy had mentioned, we selected CMGC. Then the question was why. So the main issues were that because of this project, we were moving forward on a number of different fronts. We call this third-party risk. And so we needed to move forward environmentally in getting those project documents completed. And so that was important. We needed those in place before we could start construction. The other piece is that we needed to negotiate right away. Remember, we talked about trying to control costs. So it was important as we were trying to minimize the footprint of all the different alternatives that we had and looked at what those costs were and how they rolled into the total overall cost of the project. And it also provided us, if we got to the point that if we did not have this environmental record of decision, if we did not have right away, that we had an off-ramp, that we could say, okay, we're at a point, this doesn't work for us, we need to go another direction. So CMGC allowed us to have that in our back pocket moving forward. That was a great benefit for us. We were also able to, in working with the contractor, look at the schedule and try to understand best how we can optimize, where they could look at their means and methods, additional equipment, to make sure we met the deadline that was in front of us. And it also allowed us to control the design and have a say in the design. If we went with design build, we would give up that so much of that communication. And so, as Nancy had mentioned, it's kind of that partnership that we have with the designer and the contractor with us in the middle working through that design. So that helped us with the project as well. We had three different alternatives that we were looking at. If you look at the screen, and sorry if you have a black and white copy, but the black is what currently is on alignment, and that's the part we have to vacate. We looked at three different options. So the blue, M1, was on fill through an old section of mined area. E1A was an area across a portion of the Rochelle pit, much longer bridge length, but had some other benefits, much shorter in the roadway piece. And then there's E2, which was ultimately selected. Much shorter bridge length, and that was the issue, the biggest issue. And as we met together with had a workshop with a number of MnDOT partners, went through the process, and actually E2 is what we thought was the best alternative. And that's what we put forward in our draft EIS. And so that was a big piece. Remember, we talked about moving forward in parallel. So we made that assumption E2 was the alignment, and our designs followed that alignment. As Nancy mentioned, CMGC, we did a best value, which was important for us. And the other question was the type study. So we selected we went through a process with the group and determined a number of alternatives. We have about 8 or 9 different bridge types that looked like they could have been built, but actually when we took and filtered the project goals, we actually brought it down to 4, and we had 1 preferred alternative. We thought it best met the goals. But we didn't want to control that. We wanted to make sure when we had the designer on board and the contractor on board, we would vet them out, which we did. And they did agree that the project goals meant that a steel plate girder, which was selected, moving forward with that, that was the best choice. The plate girders are very large. We're about 14.5 feet at the piers, so they're some of the bigger ones that we've had in the state, but they're not unusual. But the biggest issue was site constraint, site access, and then time constraint to build it. So As Nancy had mentioned, the contractor in our discussions brought forward the opportunity to build this causeway across the pit to get access. That was a huge deal. Instead of bringing in flexi floats, putting them in, having them in the ice and potentially break up in the ice and that risk, they came up with that alternative. It not only saved money but also reduced risk and allowed the girders to go up more in an easier fashion. So it was a benefit from a number of parks. We only had two work packages. Nancy mentioned steel and then the remainder of the project. All the bids, again, were within, as we compared them with those independent estimates, were good. To date, we've had no project issues. We're on schedule. Things are going very well. We're up out of the ground at both of the piers. As far as original, the goal of the project was to be done by November of 2017. We are on track to do that. We will have the bridge open and the roadway open by late summer, early fall of 17, and then the remainder of the time is to remove that roadway piece that's sitting on the in-place alignment. That's a part of this as well. This just shows kind of the speed that we had to go forward with that project. So from the time we hired the Parsons, the designer, and Kiewit, the engineer, in February and March to be able to have plans ready and start construction by November 2nd, this was pretty amazing. And again, doing it all in parallel. Working in the CMGC process, it allowed us to vet out a number of things. And I do want to give a shout out to a number of our MnDOT partners too, and the pieces that they need to do on the back end. There was a lot of extraordinary work that was done, and to minimize the time and to work with us together on this, along with our FHWA partners, they did a great job. So overall cost, we have a construction cost of about $156 million. Over 10 million pounds of steel, U.S. steel, is going to be in the bridge. One of the couple things that I didn't mention is there will be some finishing work going on in 2018, along with a landscaping contract that is still under development, and that will be in 28 also. The new alignment, we will be have traffic on that alignment as well. So a little bit about the Winona Bridge project. The current bridge, Bridge 5900, as bridge folks call it, was built in 1942. The design service life of that bridge when it was built was really aimed at 50 years, so we're well beyond that. That 50-year life means a couple of things. One, we're looking at service life, deck replacements, that sort of thing. But also, it also goes to the design. What did that mean? Back in that vintage, steel was very, very important. It was very costly. So they minimized all the components as best they could. The labor was cheap, so to build it was cheap. So we know that there's a lot of members that were just right size. So when we have issues, we do have issues with the bridge. It is fracture critical. It is a truss. Scour critical. We have some short timber piling. Shouldn't say short, but they are shorter type, but that does make us always want to go out and investigate that bridge and inspect it, make sure we don't have those issues. In 2008, we had closed the bridge for 2 weeks to do a number of gusset repairs, and those continue. Every time we go out and inspect, we typically find something that we go back out and repair. It is historically eligible pitch, and that's a big piece of this too. And we do have a lot of large freight that goes over the bridge. We have not only the frac sand, but we also have the farming, a lot of grain that comes over the bridge as well. So as you can see, there's still ongoing issues with corrosion. We have a number of these pieces that have ongoing section loss, and part of this project we would address all of those issues. So we do now, the bridge is safe, we look at each of these elements, we evaluate for the section loss, and it's good to carry the traffic that we have right now, but it does continue every day and every year. So just a couple of pieces on this. One is kind of throw us under the bus, and this was, we had this comment that came back to us through there were some discussions, and the newspaper had put this in place and said in the Winona Daily News, express frustration at the project's pace. And we understood this. Again, this was in August of 2013. So at that point in time, we were given authorization to move forward with CMGC. And because of this, taking that to heart, what do we do to make sure that we meet the goals of everybody's goals? So we had a new project management team that was put together, and how do we meet those goals? So get the new bridge construction started as quickly as possible. Once that's done, move the traffic to the new bridge, get the truss rehabbed. Always keep the bridge open for traffic during construction, and try to control the costs. So with those goals, we move forward. So CMGC to us was the answer. We looked at moving the construction time frame up, which we did. Previously we had said 2015, and here's the range, but we actually started in 2014, July of 2014, which was very good, and opened the new bridge by 2016, which we are on schedule to do that, and we will be there. The construction staging approach, again, will not close that bridge during construction, so that was important. Probably talked through a lot of these already, and I know we're over time. I'm just going to hit on the last point, on number two, that for the rehab of the truss, this process, the CMGC process, was wonderful for us trying to understand all of those, the members that we had working with the contractor, and identifying how that work could be done most advantageously with their means and methods, cost-wise, looking at different approaches if possible. That was very important to us, and that process went very, very well. Taking into their means and methods is something that we historically have a hard time doing with the truss bridges. We have to make an assumption and put those in the plans. Having that feedback was wonderful. I'm not going to go over these again, but these were the benefits that we saw in that project. All very true. The new bridge had a pre-selected type of structure. So it was a concrete box over the river spans and a pre-stressed girder on their approaches, and then the retrofit, as I had mentioned. So the four projects to date, work packages have been on schedule and on time. And the work package five is one that we've actually went back now. We're reevaluating with some of the stakeholders. Based on planned estimates that we had, we're quite a bit higher than what those planned estimates are. So we're looking at some opportunities potentially for decreasing some of those costs. So we're in those discussions right now, and we're looking like we're going to separate work package five into two packages, do some of the work on the through truss, and then look at some of the other pieces as part of that project. But again, working with the stakeholders to come up with that, with those changes. St. Croix Crossing Project. So the lift bridge, built 1931, historic and unique. It is one of our 24 protected bridges here in Minnesota, and the lift span along with the seven approach spans. And why replace? Again, we have a lot of ongoing corrosion with that bridge, but it's also a traffic safety issue, pedestrians and drivers. We have a number of accidents there. We are going to incorporate this as part of the project, though it will not be torn down. It just will be part of a pad and bike path for the system in that area. We did use design bid build in building the new river piece of the project with A plus B, as Nancy had mentioned. The roadway piece did use design build, so we did that quickly, and we had tools and templates that we had used before. We were very comfortable with that. Wisconsin is a partner with us. They have their own piece of the project. They're doing that design bid build, but they are sharing the cost with the river bridge with us too. And so one of the two big reasons why we did design bid build. One is the working with this Wisconsin, again, they do not have legislative approval to do design build, so we would have had to go through that process. The other part is the complexity of the bridge, trying to work through the criteria that we needed for the designer. We wanted to have that as a more of a partnership and working through approach. At the time, we did not have the authorization to use CMGC. It probably would have fit in very well with this project as well. Bridge type was predetermined. We had a stakeholder process that went over many, many years and selected an extra dose type. And so this extra dose, very unique, second one in the country. It's really the first one that uses precast segments, however. So very unique. And that's why there's a lot of interest in this project as well. But the on the approach, Minnesota approach, it's concrete boxes. In this case, we, Nancy had mentioned, we had three bidders for that main piece of the contract. So our total project cost is about $640 million, but that includes everything. Design costs, all the other pieces, the conversion of that lift bridge, like I mentioned. So the two main pieces for the bridge itself was this early foundation contract, which was $37 million, and then the Lunda Ames contract, which is $332 million. We have had some challenges and some delays, and I just want to hit on a couple of those about what is leading to those delays. One is shortly after, I shouldn't say shortly, about 2 months after Lunda Ames was given notice to proceed, their supplier of their precast forming system, the president, passed away, and about a month later, their chief engineer left the company. And so that created an issue where the forms were not on site until about 4 months late. And so that kind of rippled through a lot of the aspects of the project that we have. We've had a skilled workforce shortage. There's been times, and a lot of that with all the construction going on in the Twin Cities, we have had a skilled shortage on the site. Project bridge complexity. It is, like I mentioned, very complex. We've had tight construction and erection tolerances, and it's taking longer than anticipated in a number of the durations, which is not completely unanticipated either. Building the river, trying to build 365 days during the year, weather comes into it, and so any weather challenges create some time issues too. And then safety and quality is important. We wanted to make sure that was the number one goal, and if we needed to soften on the schedule, that was something as a team and partnering together, that was known as the highest priority. The other part, we have been talking about double shifting, but understanding some of the operations that we do are difficult to do at night. And so that's been a problem as well that we've had to look at. So originally, fall of 2016 is when the bridge is going to be completed. Now it looks like we're going to be the fall of 17. Going forward, this year we'll have segments that are getting installed on all five river piers. The work on the approaches, the cast-in-place box sections, and the ramps will be completed. And the segments that I talked about, the forms being in late, those will be completed here by the end of the summer. And into 17, and into early 17, we'll have some segments going up. We'll have the closures being made and the work completed. So, again, traffic will be on the bridge by the end of 17. I do have a couple slides just to highlight what things look like. So this is a schematic of drawing of what the piers look like completed with the tower for the state cables to get attached. And notice that between the piers we're about 100 feet, and that's the driving surface is completely between those pier columns. And that's what creates a lot of the design and construction challenges with this project. And then the precast boxes I mentioned, they're actually, it's not the full width, they're actually built in two pieces, brought in, installed, and then there's a closure link that goes in between them. And the reason I showed you this, I wanted to kind of highlight, this is what each of these look like as they get built full out. So we would have the piers, towers in place, in which every one of the piers are now fully built out, and the segments are being installed. And so it'll be this big T-shape that you'll see out in the river. Right now, this drawing, we're out about 15 or 16 segments or so, and each of the segments go out to 29 segments off of each pier. We're just starting to install the cables on this, and this would have been taken late last summer. This was off of Pier 8. So, again, a lot of work going on, but the challenge then is, so we have this link closure that I talked about where the state cables come in. We have a strut that goes across. All of those pieces need to be done sequentially, and that fits into the complexity. So you need to follow a certain process in building this. And so any sort of change ripples through the entire project. So that's part of why the delays that we have going forward.
Certainly, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just a couple more slides to go through here. We were recently asked about the Highway 169 Nine Mile Creek project. It's actually a series of four different projects. That one includes replacing the bridge over Nine Mile Creek, replacing it with most likely a permanent causeway is what we developed in preliminary design, as well as some pavement rehabilitation in the area between Highway 62 and Highway 55, and some ramp removal at an interchange, as well as some acceleration and deceleration lanes added to 169. So four projects tied together. One of the key project goals, though, is 1 year of construction. The reason that's key is we want to begin that project as soon as the Highway 100 and 494 projects complete this fall, so November of 2016, and then have it done by the end of November of 2017, at which point the I-35W and Lake Street project will start up. So we have kind of a one-year window, and with that, we are proposing to close the bridge over Nine Mile Creek during that time, and then allow one lane in each direction on Highway 169 in the remainder of that project. So those are some of the project goals, and we decided with this one to also go with the design build delivery method, and that is because of these schedule constraints. We figured they might be most achievable with design build. Also, that allows for some construction efficiency and the unique aspect of the design of building this causeway, and certain risks in the area, the poor soils and the reason for needing the Nine Mile Creek Bridge in the first place in that particular area. So with that, we're in procurement right now. We've just went through the requests for qualifications and just shortlisted a list of contractors. We have four shortlisted teams right now. There was another proposer who did not make the shortlist this time, and the reason they did not make the shortlist was there was a gap in the points. So in previous projects where I mentioned where they were all qualified, demonstrated they were qualified, and the points were close together, we moved them all on. In this case, there was a gap in the scoring that seemed a natural break, so moved the top four forward, and that's Ames, Kiewit, Kramer, and Lunda. And so with that, I'd just like to thank the committee for allowing us to present today. Again, we appreciate all the support we've had from state legislature for the use of these alternative delivery methods. We've been evolving over the last several years in the way of project management, risk management, costs, and schedules. And these alternative delivery methods have proven successful to help us achieve those goals. I'd also like to thank our Federal Highway Administration partners for the support they've given us in helping us with connecting us with other states who've used these methods in order for us to be successful. So with that, thank you, and we'll take any questions you have.
Thanks, Ms. Daubenberger. Mr. Western, I think what we will do is we do have a member of the audience who'd like to testify, and I think maybe we'll get that testimony as well, and if you'd certainly stick around. And I know we do have members with questions, but maybe it'd tie in together if we heard all the testimony first. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kelly and committee members. I've been a construction attorney. My name is Dean Thompson, and I'm with the law firm of Fabianski, Westra, Hart, and Thompson. And in that capacity, I've been a construction attorney representing highway contractors, owners, and designers for over 32 years. I've been the Minnesota State Bar Association chair of the section of construction law, been elected to the American College of Construction Lawyers, and devoted 25 years of volunteer activity as the section's legislative committee chair. And I say that only to give you a perspective of the insight I have to public procurement. I'm certainly not here testifying on behalf of the section or any contractor or the AGC or any of those entities. Instead, I'm here as a member of the public to offer what I hope is a unique experience and insight into the public procurement process. Because my interest over the years in procurement is to ensure that taxpayers are protected in this process, and they actually receive the best value from any procurement process selected. I'd like to focus my comments today on the design build process that you heard so much about. And as you know, that has two stages. First is a RFQ, a request for qualifications. And during that first stage, contractors who are unqualified are winnowed out. Certainly you don't want to exclude a qualified contractor from that process. And then in the second stage, the MnDOT evaluates design and price proposals and then selects the best value. So with that background, let me review with you some of the major procurements that have gone on under this system, because again, as a member of the public, I find some of these troubling. Let's go to the HLRT, or what's now known as the Blue Line. That was a $300 million design-build project. A team of Raytheon, Ames, and Kramer submitted, but they did not pass the RFQ process. Now, Raytheon is the nation's missile builder. Ames is a fine contractor, as we all know. So is Kramer, great bridge builder. But they were determined to be not qualified. That team took MnDOT selection to court. It's found that their disqualification was arbitrary and capricious. They got a chance to bid. The project eventually went to McCrossin, but the RFQ process was found arbitrary and capricious. Let's take a look at the 169 and 494 project. You probably remember it has these flyovers and complicated roundabouts. Lunda and Schaefer submitted an RFQ on that. They were not qualified during the pre-selection process. That project, again, eventually went to McCrossin. On the St. Croix Bridge project, you heard about that. There was a foundation package before the bridge was built. Lunda and Ames, who are actually building the bridge now, were disqualified at the beginning. They took MnDOT to court, and that pre-selection decision was found arbitrary and capricious by the court. You go to the 35E Pass, MnPass project. That was the best value process, combined evaluation of price and best value criteria. One contractor, the second low, lost that by 0.4 of a point. However, it would have saved the taxpayers $11 million had that second low been selected. One of the reasons it lost by 0.4 of a point is that it diverted traffic around a pier during the construction, just like MnDOT had designed the same road a mile to the south of that. Yet, even though it was MnDOT's design solution, they lost that project. Let me get back to the 169 Nine Mile Creek project that you just heard about, where one contractor was disqualified. That one contractor's team was C.S. McCrossin, who I mentioned had built the Blue Line for $300 million, the flyover for $80 million, is building the Highway 100 2 miles to the west of the 169 Nine Mile Creek. It had just finished the 169 project right next to its corporate headquarters on 169, but it was found to be unqualified to build this section of 169. And I think you've all been handed out some of the scoring sheets for that particular project. And frankly, the scoring is difficult to understand, this logical break that you heard about. An example, McCrossin's team included HDR, very large engineering company, ninth in the nation for all engineering, third in the nation for highways and bridges. HDR was scored low, however, because it hadn't had previous experience with MnDOT. However, Kiewit was scored very high, even though it had only by then been just selected for the Highway 53 project, not much experience. But it was selected very high because of its national and international experience. So how does MnDOT justify that disparate treatment in the scoring? But it's that type of disparate treatment that resulted in a contractor who's been found to be competent in all other jobs. I think they found CSM's, McCrossin's, project manager not to have the same qualifications as others, even though he was the main CM construction manager for the $300 million Blue Line. So I'm certainly not here as a member of the public to say design build is a bad idea. It's not, or that transportation dollars aren't needed. They are. But I am saying that as a member of the taxpaying public, it's not good policy to disqualify obviously qualified firms. It doesn't serve the interests of the taxpayers. There's many ways to improve the selection of design-build contractors so that the taxpayers are protected. And I'd be happy to explain what those ways are if the committee has any questions. In concluding my comments, however, I'd like to briefly touch on the CMGC method of contracting that's been used on Highway 53. As MnDOT says, they like to think of it as another tool in their toolbox. But some tools can be dangerous. A blowtorch is a dangerous tool, and if you don't use it properly, you can get burned, and so can the taxpayers. Well, let me give you an example of what's going on with that process. It has been awarded to Kiewit on a cost-plus basis without any guaranteed maximum price. As a result, Kiewit now has 37 project managers on that project, and I think if you asked other regional contractors, they'd say maybe 8 to 10 would be appropriate. But because there is no cost limit, we have 37. I believe MnDOT suggested that they should explore the CMGC method so they could learn how to walk before they run, but it looks like they're running very fast with this project and want to use it before perhaps they've learned how to use that very important tool. So those comments, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Thompson, if you could just also stick around, I think maybe we'll have question and comment here for everyone. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I could ask the department some three specific questions related to your slide presentation here. The first question revolves around on page 5 when it talks about the relationship between all the different parties in relation to the construction. And the very first top circle says owner. And in this respect, my guess is that you're referring to the owner as being the Department of Transportation. But with all state agencies, the real owner is obviously the taxpayers and those that pay the funding. So because the owner in this particular case is directing the parameters and the development of the strategies and so forth, my question is, if the real owner is the public, how much public involvement has been given during this process by the department, or is the department just making this based upon their own perceptions?
Ms. Duffenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I believe the question has to do with the public involvement on choosing that delivery process. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and even more than involved with that, certainly the delivery, but also the parameters about what are we needing from this particular project, et cetera. Basically, what you'll be using in order to make those determinations.
Ms. Duffenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, you are absolutely correct. There is an extensive public involvement process in the case of both the Winona Bridge and the Highway 53 bridge, Highway 53 realignment project that we've chose the CMGC process. Both on both projects, there has been extensive project the public engagement process as a part of that to define the needs, understand the challenges out there, what impacts we would have during construction. And I just have to say from what I've understood from the project managers as well as the whole team, they continue those discussions with the public even now that the project is under construction and keep continuing that dialogue. So yes, there has been an extensive public involvement process with both of those.
St. Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that comment, and I hope that continues, and I hope that there's very good preliminary discussions about it, too, because oftentimes the public feels like once decisions are made, they only respond basically to what's already decided. So please keep that involved. The second question revolves around pages 9 through 11, where it talks a little bit about what I think Mr. Thompson also talked about, qualifications in the scoring systems. If I was a contractor, would I feel comfortable under the present conditions knowing what I would be scored on in regards to various different levels of that? It almost seemed from your testimony that you kind of determine what the project is, then kind of determine what type of project style of design it's going to be, and then determine the parameters after that. In complex situations like that, it seems to me that that would be very confusing, and I'm concerned that contractors and others are always waiting to the very last minute to know exactly how they're going to be evaluated. And so can you help clarify some of that discussion?
Ms. Dubenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the process of determining what the needs are out on the project, as well as the parameters around which we should build scoring criteria, are all done before that request for qualifications or request for proposal are put out there, so that it's spelled out in what we're looking for each individual project and under each of the particular criteria that we are looking for. So, we have that available for all the contractors. They can submit questions that get responded to, so we make all contractors aware of what the question and answer is. And as far as the scoring criteria, they understand who the amount of points that are assigned to each of the particular areas.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, I think we just heard, though, that there were a couple of court cases in which the scoring requirements didn't fulfill what at least the legislature felt, I mean, the judicial system felt was appropriate, indicating to me that there must be some confusion as to how the scoring is done during the process and prior to that, which I think is somewhat troublesome for somebody that was trying to submit a contract. So is that something that has been resolved, or is that still going to be an ongoing issue?
Ms. Dunberg?
I believe I heard the court case was a part of the Blue Line LRT project, and the Met Council is the leader on that project. I personally haven't been involved, so I could certainly get some more information on that and get that to the committee.
Mr. Thompson, do you have a comment on the, I guess it was referred to as rather arbitrary, and do you have any other comment on that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, usually the courts defer to an administrative agency's decision, and the only time that they don't is if they find the decision-making has been arbitrary and capricious. And they find arbitrary and capricious behavior when the scores that you see just aren't justified by what's in the statement of qualifications. They don't match up, the scores are inconsistent, the comments don't match the scores given. You see somehow excellent qualifications, and you get a score of 3, as an example. That doesn't match up, and the courts are troubled with it.
Yeah. Ms. Dunberg, would you suggest that the department stands by their selection process, even in regards to these court cases that were considered arbitrary? Was there any change made, or was there any comments after that those cases?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we stand by our selection. As far as comments or any changes, I'd have to get back to the committee on that. But I'd also like to take this opportunity to mention that MnDOT is part of a committee along with AGEC on alternative delivery methods. So we have an established committee where we meet some challenges with these different types of delivery methods. And we are definitely open to change on that. We value the input of our industry partners, and we want to continue to improve and refine our delivery methods, so we are definitely open to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and I'll just make a comment then the last question, and my comment is that for somebody that's trying to be competitive, it's really important to know what kind of parameters are going to be judged on, and when it's determined that they haven't always been followed fairly or equitably, I think that is a concern, and I certainly would like you to take that back to the commissioner and others. My final question is somewhat related, And that has to do with, on page 11 and 12, when you talk about the estimates that came in, it struck me as the engineer's estimates were almost consistently lower than what the actual bid that was awarded, which indicates a couple of things to me. One, either our engineers are inadequate to actually plan for the estimate, or maybe the other possibility is maybe some of the design requirements are undervalued by our engineers as well. But they're in almost all cases about 10% what the actual award was. Well, that's a significant difference. And if we're awarding contracts that are 10% higher than our engineers, we probably aren't doing as good a job in planning for our financial needs in the future as well. So was there an inherent reason why these were that far behind, or is it just part of the process?
Stubmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 10% difference is something that is not unusual between all of our delivery methods. And sometimes the engineer's estimate is actually higher than the low bid or several bids, and sometimes it's lower. In the case here, you saw that the engineer's estimate was lower, but it really does tend to fluctuate. And I have to say, too, that we, within MnDOT as well as our contracting community, our consultants, we have some good cost estimators, and we'll see some differences from time to time overall in the program, but 10% is not unusual, but it can go either way, higher or lower. In this case, this the engineer's estimate was lower, but that's not unusual.
Thank you. And members, we are getting a decent list here, so what I would ask going forward, if you would limit your questions here to your first question and maybe a follow-up to that question, but then we'll come back to you if you've got several questions. Representative Bernardi.
Mr. Chair, can we start that rule after? Because one question is really simple, okay? This is how long can you let
So are you saying you want two questions?
Well, no.
That was the question.
That was you just find out down to one question. Me. How long is the Trunk Highway 53 bridge expected to last? I'm just curious to know that, but that's not really the questions I really want.
I'm sure you can clarify that. Go ahead, Representative Bernardi. But
okay, so how long is the bridge expected to last? Trunk Highway 53 bridge.
Oh, Mr. Western.
Mr. Chairman, the design of that bridge, we accounted for a 100-year design life. And so what we have in that project is higher criteria on the concrete that goes in the deck, and also we have stainless steel bars in the deck in the driving surface. And so that should allow that bridge to last 100 years.
Okay,
potentially.
That's good to know.
Representative Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to hear that. And then a question I have is, Representative Petersburg asked questions about this too, but community engagement, a couple questions about that. At what point do you start the community engagement? Is it before it's been scoped, and so their people are involved in actually the scope of the project? And then I want to know, do you incorporate context-sensitive solutions in developing the scope and design of the project, and so you take into the community, the technical and the regulatory needs, and then I want to just find out, how do you prevent the left hand from not knowing what the right hand is doing? Because I've heard that on projects before that were design build or one of these, it's not necessarily design build, but B and D, I don't know all of these acronyms, but that the community wanted something, and MnDOT said, no, you can't have it. And then the contractor built it, but not within specifications, but they were willing to tear it out and redo it with a 2% grade. So my just question is, how do you make sure that the community needs are being addressed throughout the project when you have this type of method going forward? Who is responsible for ensuring the community engagement happens and the needs are being met on the project?
Mr. Western, or Ms. Doppenberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the public engagement does need to take place during the scoping phase so we can make sure we're incorporating the needs of all the needs in the area of the project. or if we can't incorporate them with the project, that we're aware of those needs and communicate to the public what we will be able to incorporate with the project and what we won't, when we can possibly get to those needs or how they can be addressed. That needs to happen during scoping. We are, as a department, getting better about reaching out during the scoping phase, and in fact, one of MnDOT's wildly important goals right now is about customer engagement and getting out and understanding those needs, the needs of our customers, very early on, so that could be taken into consideration. And then, yes, context-sensitive solutions are incorporated into the design of the bridge or the larger project in the case of the projects we discussed here today. So that's an area we are definitely moving more in the direction of in terms of understanding our customers' needs and making sure that those are being incorporated or at least understood as we define a project.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, just one follow-up question, just to get, because I did ask it already. How do you make sure that the public needs are being met in the project? Who's responsible for that? Is it the person building the project? Is it MnDOT?
Ms. Dobenberg.
Yes. And so that could be a one-answer question, but in addition to that, who is making sure that happens and the community engagement continues throughout the process?
Ms. Dunberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a MnDOT project. MnDOT is responsible for meeting those needs and understanding the needs of the community. But we do have a very large project team in the case of these projects, so that coordination and collaboration needs to take place in order to make sure we're addressing those needs. So, yes, it's MnDOT's responsibility, but we definitely need to work collaboratively with the contractor. There are things that come up during the project that can be added or changed or what have you if there's some sort of an effect that we are causing with the project that needs to be addressed. And so that's why these projects that have used the alternative delivery methods have been more successful that way in that we've been working very collaboratively from day one on the project.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dobenberger, I was looking at page 26, and this might be tangential to the discussion, but I thought I heard you say that the old St. Croix Crossing Bridge was going to be used for trails and so forth, and it looks like the new one also has trails on it as well. Is that right?
Ms. Dobenberger.
Yes, that's actually a very exciting part of the project. So the new bridge will have a trail. The old bridge will be renovated into a pedestrian facility, and there are new trails that are being built along each side of the river. So we're calling it a loop trail. It's about a 5-mile loop for running, biking, walking, what have you. That'll be completed with the project. So, yeah, the old bridge will serve as that, as well as the new bridge about a mile downstream to have that crossing for pedestrian and bikes as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. It sounds like there's a lot of redundancy for trails, and I thought we were building bridges for cars and trucks. 12 foot across the trail here on the new bridge, taken as a percentage of the cost relative to proportionally with the width of the bridge, that's $70-some million, Ms. Dobenberger, so that we can have a looped trail and feel good about it. So I don't know. I wonder how was that decision made?
Ms. Dunbar.
So this loop trail was a key to the mitigation for the project. And when I say mitigation, it's providing something for something we're taking away. So we're taking this historic bridge out of service, and it's going to serve as a pedestrian bike facility, but it's an impact to the historic significance of the bridge. And so because of that, there is mitigation required for the project. This loop trail and utilizing the old bridge for pedestrian and bikes is part of that mitigation package.
Mr. Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dobenberger, I don't know what mitigation means. So somebody in the community is losing the historic, it looks really pretty type of thing. So to make them feel better, we're going to put a trail on the bridge, too. Is that what you're telling me mitigation means here?
Ms. Dunberg.
Yeah. In this case, where we're impacting a historically significant property, we're required federally to provide mitigation. In this case, part of that mitigation package that was negotiated was that it's being used for a bike and pedestrian facility. So it's still going to be out there. It's still going to be used. The lift mechanism will still take place. But yes, that is part of why we are doing this.
So maybe just a clarification, Ms. Dahlberger, I understand the mitigation for the historic bridge, but who made the decision that the trail would go over to the new bridge? Ms. Dahlberger.
I'm probably not the best one to have all the history on the project, but I believe that the loop trail itself is part of that mitigation. So not only using the old bridge for pedestrian and bikes, but building those connections down to the new bridge and adding the trail on the new bridge. It's all part of the loop system.
Mr. Chair, I would think that this might be worthy of further exploration. I know you want to move on and another question here, but I don't know. Lots of questions here. Government's too big and out of control, and we're supposed to be getting cars and trucks across here, and we're doing a loop trail. I'm troubled. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have about both Highway 53 and the St. Croix is kind of that original decision that was made. So, for example, I heard you say that we made an original decision to build on the easement even as we were agreeing to move it later. So there was a decision made early to build it in a way that you knew you'd eventually have to build a new one in the future.
Ms. Dahlberger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer that question to Mr. Western. I think he was the one describing that.
Okay. Mr. Western.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, part of when the project was built in 1960, there was an agreement made that based on the request that the department would vacate that area.
And why?
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chairman, because of the minerals that are below that area, and at the time it was originally built, that was the most cost-effective direct route for the Trunk Highway 53 alignment.
But, Mr. Chair, I think the point is it was then the most cost-effective, but you were promising to build a new one. So then it wouldn't be cost-effective anymore. This has always confounded me about this. There's no way you could think when we replace it in the future that will still be the most cost-effective route. Because you had to build two bridges.
Mr. Western.
Mr. Chairman, I think part of the piece of the discussion was that we did not know that there would be a relocation needed in the future. It was part of the agreement at that time that if the owner of that area needed and wanted to mine that area, that they would inform the department and we would be required to relocate or use a different off system to create the travel routes for the public.
And then, Mr. Chair, again, about apparently the St. Croix crossing, the same thing. It's initially the reason why, I mean, did anyone, this bridge doesn't connect any major economic centers, but $640 million is the total cost. I'm assuming that's the most ever for any bridge in Minnesota. Doesn't connect any major economic centers. Did we know at the time we made that decision how much it would cost, in which case why would we have even agreed to do it?
Mr. Western, Ms. Dahlberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The lift bridge, when it was built, much like Mr. Western was describing the Winona Bridge, was probably built with a 50-year time frame in mind, and without knowing that it was going to be a designated historic property. And it's come to the end of its useful life for carrying highway traffic now and needs to be replaced. So there had been quite a bit of work done to identify where the new crossing would be, and this alignment that was chosen was the most effective for a number of reasons, But yeah, this part of the St. Croix River and the length this bridge needs to be, it is a more expensive bridge.
I think, Mr. Chair, you know, on both of these, we're talking almost $1 billion between two bridges, and it's just very hard for me to understand where that initial decision came, because we could cross the Hudson.
Thank you. Representative Eagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a lot of questions, but in the interest of time, I'll limit it to one. It's for Mr. Thompson. Mr. Thompson, you mentioned that, some of the court rulings and things regarding the qualifications of these contractors, which are based on this point system, have been arbitrary and capricious. And I've looked at some of the sheets here, and it's very difficult to understand how so many differences could occur. Under the CMGC process, it says the contractor may be procured based on qualifications or best value, and obviously this is the points thing. Do you have any ideas of how this process could be better? Because it seems like it's these points, there doesn't seem to be any guidelines. They're just awarded these points.
Mr. Thompson? Chair, committee members, that's an excellent question. There's many ideas that could be brought to bear. Let me focus on three for the design-build method and close with the CMGC method. Now, many states, as an example, have gone to third-party evaluators who have a great deal of experience in evaluating proposals. And I bring this option up not to question MnDOT's good faith, because they certainly do operate in good faith, but sometimes more than good faith is needed. You need consistency, experience, demonstrated competence, and also transparency into how the scoring is done so everybody has confidence in the system. So that's one idea. Second is, how often is a scoring system used to make the award? Sometimes I've heard comments that we want community involvement, sometimes stainless steel, rebar, whatever. That can all be put in at the front end of a performance specification. If you want someone, as an example, who's got 15 years of experience, you can put that in the performance criteria as well. And then if you either pass or fail, have you provided the stainless steel or not? If you have, you're qualified, and then it goes by low price, and you get rid of a lot of this subjective scoring. And third, about the transparency. Well, right now you've seen a lot of the scoring criteria, a lot of scores, but you do not have in front of you the statement of qualifications. Now, if you were a reviewing agency or a committee reviewing the practices, how would you know that the scores match what you've seen on the statement of qualifications? You don't, and you cannot, because the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act keeps the statement of qualifications secret until the award has been made, at which time it's too late to do anything about it. Now, you certainly don't want to share confidential proprietary information among competing bidders, but statements of qualifications, how many projects you've done, who your proposed project manager is, that's not proprietary or confidential. That should be shared so that those who are interested in making sure that the process is going correctly, members of the public, contractors, they can actually have a meaningful protest, and the public can be protected thereby. Those are three good reasons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eagle, just a follow-up comment. I think most of our constituents, taxpayers, think when we're going out for bid on a project as big as any of these bridges or whatever, that the best bid gets the deal. And this has been eye-opening to me with these many different methods and this scoring and everything else. And I think it's very troubling that from a transparency standpoint, I think there's some good room for improvement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dellenberger, you'd mentioned you're part of a larger group, I sounded to me like a roundtable discussion for with all of the court cases that were noted and issues discovered. So nothing, was there anything discussed in this group that suggested we could improve our processes in regards to exactly what Representative Uecklin was talking about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. Yes, that is kind of a roundtable group. So members of AGC are a part of that group, and we have changed our processes over time based on input we've gotten from our contracting community. So yes, that is definitely indeed the case. And also in terms of the selections, there was a question about having a third party. AGC, the Associated General Contractors, does provide MnDOT a third party representative on the selection panel to have some of that independence along with the selection.
Mr. Thompson, you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it is true that the AGC has one member out of five on the review panel. However, because no one in the contracting community really wants to serve on that board, otherwise they disqualify themselves from these projects, the person that MnDOT has, the last three people that they've proposed are former MnDOT employees. So we really have a group of MnDOT employees making these decisions.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several times you mentioned that MnDOT essentially, I interpret as MnDOT loses control once they get into the design build. Can you clarify at what point and exactly what MnDOT cannot specify during the construction of the design build process?
Ms. Dalton-Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I might have made it sound like we lose control. We don't lose control. It's just that we don't have the same level of control over the design as we do with some other methods like design, bid, build, or now with our CMGC method where there is more time set aside for just the design. And then, as I mentioned, with CMGC, we have the contractor at the table giving input to the design. But in design build, the design is just more fast-tracked. And then MnDOT reviews the design. But to get at the question I think you're asking is, what do we put into our contract documents to ensure that we get the design that we're looking for, if that's the main question? Yes, we provide performance specifications to identify what we absolutely need for a design on the different elements of a project. And then the contracting team needs to ensure that they're meeting those specifications.
Can I ask one more question? We've talked about the St. Croix Bridge.
I was just seeing if you were listening. But go ahead.
Delayed. Okay. Now, I'm hearing that there are problems with the St. Croix Bridge, and it does show that you're operating you're late. With the changes or whatever you have to do to get the bridge to opening status, who is bearing the cost of all of this, the extra year taking place?
Ms. Dalton-Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That's a very good question, and it's what we're working through with the contractor right now. So the contractor has proposed to us that the opening of the project or substantial completion needs to be a year later than they originally proposed. However, the delays are something we're currently, MnDOT is currently working through with the contractor to understand what went into the delays and what the contractor is entitled to, or we need to assess some liquidated damages because of it. So that's all being negotiated right now. Not yet determined.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are they going to maintain the lift capacity for watercraft that exists there now?
Ms. Dalton-Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, they will. Yes, okay. The lift mechanism will still need to continue even as a lift bridge, so it'll be down for crossing of peds and bikes, and then it will need to be lifted to allow watercraft to pass underneath.
I have a historic comment besides that, Mr. Chairman. My great-grandparents lived at the east end of that bridge and what was called the Holton Hill. I don't know if that name is still there or not. what they used to talk about, and he lived to be about 101 or so, and they used to talk about, you know, Steve Swigum used to say, if in place of rail or public transit, why don't we just give everybody another horse? And I will ask the same thing similar to that. Why they used to cross that river on barges that they hauled back and forth by horses. So instead of this expensive, this is Draskowski like this, Draskowski would like this, why didn't we just offer up some more barges with some more horses that we wouldn't have to spend all this money for hauling people and freight and cars back and forth? Did you consider that?
Ms. Dahlberger, you can comment if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall options that involved horses, but a number of different options were looked at when it came to proposing a new crossing, as well as what we would do with the existing lift bridge, and to get the project to agreement with all agencies and stakeholders involved, it needed to remain out there as a pedestrian and bike facility. It's going to be rehabilitated.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates to the financing for the St. Croix Bridge. And if you could give me a summary of how that was financed, I'd appreciate that. And then the related question with that is, how did the department consider the opportunity cost of that other things would be foregone, and did you look at what was lost as a result of that, and perhaps bridges in other parts of the state, or possibly basically road maintenance? So if you could answer that, I'd like to know that.
Ms. Dahlberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The financing, I think I will need to follow up with the committee in terms of how much state and federal dollars is on that project. I've lost sight of that to some extent, but one thing I can tell you is, in terms of the river bridge itself, the project we discussed mainly today, that is a 50-50 split cost share with Wisconsin, state of Wisconsin. And then, of course, they're funding their approach project. We funded our approach project. But there are different colors money that went into it. The bridge was also a part of the Chapter 152 bridge program that was established in the 2008 legislative session. So it needed to be addressed per the legislation prior to 2018. And as I've made mention to previously, that the project that has been decided on is the project that is most cost effective and fallible to all the stakeholders in terms of the process, the environmental process that we went through to decide on an option. So in terms of moving that project forward, compared to other projects, it was one project we needed to move forward as part of the Chapter 152 legislation.
Well, along with that, that's approximately a year delayed now. Do we know what the cost of that delay has been or will be?
Mr. Chair, the cost of additional cost of the project due to delays and that sort of thing is something we are still currently working out with the contractor, so we don't have that cost to date.
Any idea of an estimate or anything close?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't have a good handle on that at this point.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Anderson, final question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Thompson, I'm kind of fascinated to listen to your explanation of all the scoring today into further detail. Assuming that you know about the 9 Mile Creek scoring, sir?
Yes.
I just wanted to know, what is your summary opinion of what happened with the scoring? I've been trying to go through some of these, and I'm sure you've got an opinion. I'd love to hear it.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as I say, I'm not here representing anyone. I'm here as a concerned taxpayer, but I did take the time to review what's available to the public, and I think my opinion after reviewing it is that we have inconsistent scoring from people who did not follow the scoring manual in how they applied their scores, and perhaps were not properly trained on how to make scoring. Otherwise, it's difficult to understand the range of scores among five people from the same department about the same subject, and it's difficult to understand the disparate treatment that teams got from the same people as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of our testifiers today, Mr. Western, Ms. Daldenberger, Mr. Thompson. Thank you for being here. And members, we'll be meeting on Wednesday in the basement, and we will be going over the governor's supplemental budget. We will hear presentations by MnDOT, DPS, and the Met Council. So thank you for your time today, and this meeting is adjourned.